7, and 4, and 8, and 6, and 2, and 10, and so on. And after each figure was disposed of, it was as much as I could do to get a bite or a sup before the next came, while he sat at his ease, guessing nothing, and eating bacon and hot roll in, if I may be allowed the expression, a gorging and gormandizing manner. For such reasons, I was very glad when 10 o'clock came, and we started for Miss Havisham's, though I was not at all at my ease regarding the manner in which I should equip myself under that lady's roof. Within a quarter of an hour we came to Miss Havisham's house, which was of old brick and dismal, and had a great many iron bars to it. Some of the windows had been walled up. Of those that remained, all the lower were rustily barred. There was a courtyard in front, and that was barred, so we had to wait, after ringing the bell, until someone should come to open it. While we waited at the gate, I peeped in. Even then Mr. Pumblechook said, "And 14. But I pretended not to hear him, and saw that at the side of the house there was a large brewery. No brewing was going on in it, and none seemed to have gone on for a long time. A window was raised, and a clear voice demanded, "What name?" To which my conductor replied, "Pumblechook." The voice returned, "Quite right," and the window was shut again, and a young lady came across the courtyard with keys in her hand.
"This," said Mr. Pumblechook, "is Pip."
"This is Pip, is it?"
returned the young lady, who was very pretty and seemed very proud.
"Come in, Pip."
Mr. Pumblechook was coming in also, when she stopped him with the gate.
"Oh," she said. "Did you wish to see Miss Havisham?"
"If Miss Havisham wishes to see me," returned Mr. Pumblechook, discomfited.
"Ah," said the girl. "But you see, she don't."
She said it so finally, and in such an undiscussable way, that Mr. Pumblechook, though in a condition of ruffled dignity, could not protest. But he eyed me severely, as if I'd done anything to him, and departed with the words reproachfully delivered,
"Boy, let your behaviour here be a credit unto them which brought you up by hand."
I was not free from apprehension that he would come back to propound through the gate,
"And 16?
But he didn't. My young conductress locked the gate, and we went across the courtyard. It was paved and clean, but grass was growing in every crevice. The brewery buildings had a little lane of communication with it, and the wooden gates of that lane stood open, and all the brewery beyond stood open, away to the high enclosing wall, and all was empty and disused. The cold wind seemed to blow colder there than outside the gate, and it made a shrill noise in howling in and out of the open sides of the brewery, like the noise of wind in the rigging of a ship at sea. She saw me looking at it, and she said,
"You could drink without hurt all the strong beer that's brewed there now, boy."
"I should think I could, miss," said I, in a shy way.
"Better not try to brew beer there now, or it would turn out sour, boy. Don't you think so?"
It looks like it, miss."
"Not that anybody means to try," she added, "for that's all done with, and the place will stand as idle as it is till it falls. As to strong beer, there's enough of it in the cellars already to drown the manor house."
"Is that the name of this house, miss?"
"One of its names, boy."
"It has more than one, then, miss?"
"One more. Its other name was Satis, which is Greek or Latin or Hebrew or all three, or all one to me, for enough."
"Enough house," said I. "That's a curious name, miss."
"Yes," she replied, "but it meant more than it said. It meant, when it was given, that whoever had this house could want nothing else. They must have been easily satisfied in those days, I should think. But don't loiter, boy."
Though she called me boy so often, and with a carelessness that was far from complimentary, she was about my own age. She seemed much older than I, of course, being a girl, and beautiful and self-possessed, and she was as scornful of me as if she'd been 21 and a queen. We went into the house by a side door. The great front entrance had 2 chains across it outside, and the first thing I noticed was that the passages were all dark, and that she'd left a candle burning there. She took it up, and we went through dark passages and up a staircase,
and still it was all dark, and only the candle lighted us. At last we came to the door of a room, and she said, "Go in." I answered, more in shyness than politeness, "After you, miss." To this she returned, "Don't be ridiculous, boy. I'm not going in," and scornfully walked away, and what was worse, took the candle with her. This was very uncomfortable, and I was half afraid. However, the only thing to be done, being to knock at the door, I knocked, and was told from within to enter. I entered, therefore, and found myself in a pretty large room, well lighted with wax candles. No glimpse of daylight was to be seen in it. It was a dressing room, as I supposed from the furniture, though much of it was of forms and uses then quite unknown to me. But prominent in it was a draped table with a gilded looking-glass, and that I made out at first sight to be a fine lady's dressing-table. Whether I should have made out this object so soon, if there had been no fine lady sitting at it, I cannot say. In an armchair, with an elbow resting on the table and her head leaning on that hand, sat the strangest lady I have ever seen, or shall ever see. She was dressed in rich materials, satins and lace and silks, all white. Her shoes were white, and she had a long white veil dependent from her hair, and she had bridal flowers in her hair, but her hair was white. Some bright jewels sparkled on her neck and on her hands, and some other jewels lay sparkling on the table. Dresses less splendid than the dress she wore, and half-packed trunks were scattered about. She had not quite finished dressing, for she had but one shoe on. The other was on the table near her hand. Her veil was but half arranged. Her watch and chain were not put on, and some lace for her bosom lay with those trinkets, and with her handkerchief and gloves, and some flowers and a prayer-book, all confusedly heaped about the looking-glass. It was not in the first few moments that I saw all those things, though I saw more of them in the first moments than might be supposed. But I saw that everything within my view, which ought to be white, had been white long ago, and had lost its luster, and was faded in yellow. I saw that the bride within the bridal dress had withered like the dress, and like the flowers, and had no brightness left but the brightness of her sunken eyes. I saw that the dress had been put upon the rounded figure of a young woman, and that the figure upon which it now hung loose had shrunk to skin and bone. Once I had been taken to see some ghastly waxwork at the fair, representing I know not what impossible personage lying in state. Once I had been taken to one of our old marsh churches to see a skeleton in the ashes of a rich dress that had been dug out of a vault under the church pavement. Now, waxwork and skeleton seemed to have dark eyes that moved and looked at me. I should have cried out if I could.
"Who is it?" said the lady at the table.
"Pip, ma'am."
"Pip?"
"Mr. Pumblechook's boy, ma'am. Come to play."
"Come nearer. Let me look at you. Come close."
It was when I stood before her, avoiding her eyes, that I took note of the surrounding objects in detail, and saw that her watch had stopped at 9:20, and that a clock in the room had stopped at 9:20.
"Look at me," said Miss Havisham. "You are not afraid of a woman who has never seen the sun since you were born."
I regret to state that I was not afraid of telling the enormous lie comprehended in the answer, "No."
"Do you know what I touch here?"
she said, laying her hands one upon the other on her left side.
"Yes, ma'am."
It made me think of the young man.
"What do I touch?"
"Your heart."
"Broken."
She uttered the word with an eager look, and with strong emphasis, and with a weird smile that had a kind of boast in it. Afterwards, she kept her hands there for a little while, and slowly took them away, as if they were heavy.
"I am tired," said Miss Havisham. "I want diversion, and I have done with men and women. Play."
I think it will be conceded by my most disputatious reader that she could hardly have directed an unfortunate boy to do anything in the wide world more difficult to be done under the circumstances.
"I sometimes have sick fancies," she went on, "and I have a sick fancy
that I want to see some play. There, there, with an impatient movement of the fingers of her right hand. Play, play, play. For a moment, with the fear of my sisters working me before my eyes, I had a desperate idea of starting round the room in the assumed character of Mr. Pumblechook's chaise cart, but I felt myself so unequal to the performance that I gave it up and stood looking at Miss Havisham in what I suppose she took for a dogged manner, inasmuch as she said, when we had taken a good look at each other,
"Are you sullen and obstinate?"
"No, ma'am. I'm very sorry for you. I'm very sorry I can't play just now. If you complain of me, I shall get into trouble with my sister. So I would do it if I could, but it's so new here and so strange and so fine and melancholy."
I stopped, fearing I might say too much, or had already said it, and we took another look at each other. Before she spoke again, she turned her eyes from me and looked at the dress she wore and at the dressing table, and finally at herself in the looking-glass.
"So new to him," she muttered. "So old to me. So strange to him. So familiar to me. So melancholy to both of us. Call Estella."
As she was still looking at the reflection of herself, I thought she was still talking to herself, and kept quiet.
"Call Estella," she repeated, flashing a look at me. "You can do that. Call Estella at the door."
To stand in the dark in the mysterious passage of an unknown house, bawling Estella to a scornful young lady neither visible nor responsive, and feeling it a dreadful liberty so to roar out her name, was almost as bad as playing to order. But she answered at last, and her light came along the long dark passage like a star. Miss Havisham beckoned her to come close, and took up a jewel from the table, and tried its effect upon her fair young bosom, and against her pretty brown hair.
"Your own one day, my dear, and you will use it well. Let me see you play cards with this boy."
"With this boy? Why, he's a common labouring boy."
I thought I overheard Miss Havisham answer, only it seemed so unlikely.
"Well, you can break his heart." "What do you play, boy?"
asked Estella of myself, with the greatest disdain.
"Nothing but beggar my neighbour, miss."
"Beggar him," said Miss Havisham to Estella.
So we sat down to cards. It was then I began to understand that everything in the room had stopped, like the watch and the clock, a long time ago. I noticed that Miss Havisham put down the jewel exactly on the spot from which she had taken it up. As Estella dealt the cards, I glanced at the dressing-table again, and saw that the shoe upon it, once white, now yellow, had never been worn. I glanced down at the foot from which the shoe was absent, and saw that the silk stocking on it, once white, now yellow, had been trodden ragged. Without this arrest of everything, this standing still of all the pale, decayed objects, not even the withered bridal dress on the collapsed form could have looked so like grave clothes, or the long veil so like a shroud. So she sat, corpse-like, as we played at cards, the frillings and trimmings on her bridal dress looking like earthy paper. I knew nothing then of the discoveries that are occasionally made of bodies buried in ancient times, which fall to powder in the moment of being distinctly seen. But I have often thought since that she must have looked as if the admission of the natural light of day would have struck her to dust.
"He calls the knaves jacks, this boy," said Estella with disdain,
before our first game was out.
"And what coarse hands he has, and what thick boots."
I had never thought of being ashamed of my hands before, but I began to consider them a very indifferent pair. Her contempt for me was so strong that it became infectious, and I caught it. She won the game, and I dealt. I misdealt, as was only natural, when I knew she was lying in wait for me to do wrong, and she denounced me for a stupid, clumsy, labouring boy.
"You say nothing of her,"
remarked Miss Havisham to me as she looked on.
"She says many hard things of you, but you say nothing of her. What do you think of her?"
"I don't like to say," I stammered. "Tell me in my ear," said Miss Havisham, bending down.
"I think she is very proud," I replied in a whisper.
"Anything else?"
"I think she is very pretty."
"Anything else?"
"I think she's very insulting."
She was looking at me then with a look of supreme aversion. "Anything else?"
"I think I should like to go home."
"And never see her again, though she is so pretty."
"I'm not sure that I shouldn't like to see her again, but I should like to go home now."
"You shall go soon," said Miss Havisham aloud. "Play the game out."
Saving for the one weird smile at first, I should have felt almost sure that Miss Havisham's face could not smile. It had dropped into a watchful and brooding expression, most likely when all the things about her had become transfixed, and it looked as if nothing could ever lift it up again. Her chest had dropped so that she stooped, and her voice had dropped so that she spoke low and with a dead lull upon her. Altogether, she had the appearance of having dropped, body and soul, within and without, under the weight of a crushing blow. I played the game to an end with Estella, and she beckoned me. She threw the cards down on the table when she had won them all, as if she despised them for having been won of me.
"When shall I have you here again?" said Miss Havisham. "Let me think."
I was beginning to remind her that today was Wednesday, when she checked me with her former impatient movement of the fingers of her right hand.
"There, there, I know nothing of days of the week. I know nothing of weeks of the year. Come again after 6 days. You hear?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Estella, take him down. Let him have something to eat, and let him roam and look about him while he eats. Go, Pip."
I followed the candle down, as I had followed the candle up, and she stood it in the place where we had found it. Until she opened the side entrance, I had fancied, without thinking about it, that it must necessarily be night-time. The rush of daylight quite confounded me, and made me feel as if I'd been in the candle-light of the strange room many hours.
"You are to wait here, you boy,"
said Estella, and disappeared and closed the door. I took the opportunity of being alone in the courtyard to look at my coarse hands and my common boots. My opinion of those accessories was not favourable. They had never troubled me before, but they troubled me now as vulgar appendages. I determined to ask Joe why he had ever taught me to call those picture cards jacks, which ought to be called knaves. I wish Joe had been rather more genteelly brought up, and then I should have been so too. She came back with some bread and meat and a little mug of beer. She put the mug down on the stones of the yard and gave me the bread and meat without looking at me, as insolently as if I were a dog in disgrace. I was so humiliated, hurt, spurned, offended, angry, sorry. I cannot hit upon the right name for the smart. God knows what its name was. The tears started to my eyes. The moment they sprang there, the girl looked at me with quick delight in having been the cause of them. This gave me power to keep them back and to look at her, so she gave a contemptuous toss, but with a sense I thought of having made too sure that I was so wounded, and left me. But when she was gone, I looked about me for a place to hide my face in, and got behind one of the gates in the brewery lane, and leaned my sleeve against the wall there, and leaned my forehead on it, and cried. As I cried, I kicked the wall and took a hard twist at my hair. So bitter were my feelings, and so sharp was the smart without a name that needed counteraction. My sister's bringing up had made me sensitive. In the little world in which children have their existence, whosoever brings them up, there is nothing so finely perceived and so finely felt as injustice. It may be only small injustice that the child can be exposed to, but the child is small, and its world is small, and its rocking horse stands as many hands high, according to scale, as a big-boned Irish hunter. Within myself, I had sustained from my babyhood a perpetual conflict with injustice.
I had known from the time when I could speak that my sister, in her capricious and violent coercion, was unjust to me. I had cherished a profound conviction that her bringing me up by hand gave her no right to bring me up by jerks. Through all my punishments, disgraces, fasts and vigils, and other penitential performances, I had nursed this assurance, and to my communing so much with it in a solitary and unprotected way, I in great part refer the fact that I was morally timid and very sensitive. I got rid of my injured feelings for the time by kicking them into the brewery wall and twisting them out of my hair, and then I smoothed my face with my sleeve and came from behind the gate. The bread and meat were acceptable, and the beer was warming and tingling, and I was soon in spirits to look about me. To be sure, it was a deserted place, down to the pigeon house in the brewery yard, which had been blown crooked on its pole by some high wind, and would have made the pigeons think themselves at sea, if there had been any pigeons there to be rocked by it. But there were no pigeons in the dovecot, no horses in the stable, no pigs in the sty, no malt in the storehouse, no smells of grain and beer in the copper or the vat. All the uses and scents of the brewery might have evaporated with its last reek of smoke. In a by-yard there was a wilderness of empty casks, which had a certain sour remembrance of better days lingering about them. But it was too sour to be accepted as a sample of the beer that was gone, and in this respect I remembered those recluses as being like most others. Behind the furthest end of the brewery was a rank garden with an old wall, not so high but that I could struggle up and hold on long enough to look over it, and see that the rank garden was the garden of the house, and that it was overgrown with tangled weeds, but that there was a track upon the green and yellow paths, as if someone sometimes walked there, and that Estella was walking away from me even then. But she seemed to be everywhere, for when I yielded to the temptation presented by the casks and began to walk on them, I saw her walking on them at the end of the yard of casks. She had her back towards me, and held her pretty brown hair spread out in her two hands, and never looked round, and passed out of my view directly. So, in the brewery itself, by which I mean the large paved lofty place in which they used to make the beer, and where the brewing utensils still were. When I first went into it, and rather oppressed by its gloom, stood near the door looking about me, I saw her pass among the extinguished fires, and ascend some light iron stairs, and go out by a gallery high overhead, as if she were going out into the sky. It was in this place, and at this moment, that a strange thing happened to my fancy. I thought it a strange thing then, and I thought it a stranger thing long afterwards. I turned my eyes, a little dimmed by looking up at the frosty light, towards a great wooden beam in a low nook of the building near me on my right hand. And I saw a figure hanging there by the neck, a figure all in yellow-white, with but one shoe to the feet, and it hung so that I could see that the faded trimmings of the dress were like earthy paper, and that the face was Miss Havisham's, with a movement going over the whole countenance as if she were trying to call to me. In the terror of seeing the figure, and in the terror of being certain that it had not been there a moment before, I at first ran from it, and then ran towards it, and my terror was greatest of all when I found no figure there. Nothing less than the frosty light of the cheerful sky, the sight of people passing beyond the bars of the courtyard gate, and the reviving influence of the rest of the bread and meat and beer would have brought me round. Even with those aids, I might not have come to myself as soon as I did, but that I saw Estella approaching with the keys to let me out. She would have some fair reason for looking down upon me, I thought, if she saw me frightened, and she should have no fair reason. She gave me a triumphant glance in passing me, as if she rejoiced that my hands were so coarse and my boots were so thick, and she opened the gate and stood holding it. I was passing out without looking at her, when she touched me with a taunting hand.
"Why don't you cry?"
"Because I don't want to."
"You do," said she. "You've been crying till you're half blind,
and you're near crying again now."
She laughed contemptuously, pushed me out, and locked the gate upon me. I went straight to Mr. Pumblechook's, and was immensely relieved to find him not at home. So, leaving word with the shopman on what day I was wanted at Miss Havisham's again, I set off on the 4-mile walk to our forge, pondering as I went along on all I had seen, and deeply revolving that I was a common labouring boy, that my hands were coarse, that my boots were thick, that I had fallen into a despicable habit of calling knaves jacks, that I was much more ignorant than I had considered myself last night, and generally that I was in a low-lived, bad way. Chapter 9. When I reached home, my sister was very curious to know all about Miss Havisham's, and asked a number of questions, and I soon found myself getting heavily bumped from behind in the nape of the neck and the small of the back, and having my face ignominiously shoved against the kitchen wall, because I did not answer those questions at sufficient length. If a dread of not being understood be hidden in the breasts of other young people to anything like the extent to which it used to be hidden in mine, which I consider probable, as I have no particular reason to suspect myself of having been a monstrosity, it is the key to many reservations. I felt convinced that if I described Miss Havisham's as my eyes had seen it, I should not be understood. Not only that, but I felt convinced that Miss Havisham, too, would not be understood, and although she was perfectly incomprehensible to me, I entertained an impression that there would be something coarse and treacherous in my dragging her as she really was, to say nothing of Miss Estella, before the contemplation of Mrs. Joe. Consequently, I said as little as I could, and had my face shoved against the kitchen wall. The worst of it was that the bullying old Pumblechook, preyed upon by a devouring curiosity to be informed of all I had seen and heard, came gaping over in his chaise cart at tea-time to have the details divulged to him. And the mere sight of the torment, with his fishy eyes and mouth open, his sandy hair inquisitively on end, and his waistcoat heaving with windy arithmetic, made me vicious in my reticence.
"Well, boy?"
Uncle Pumblechook began as soon as he was seated in the chair of honour by the fire.
"How did you get on uptown?"
I answered, "Pretty well, sir,"
and my sister shook her fist at me.
"Pretty well," Mr. Pumblechook repeated. "Pretty well is no answer. Tell us what you mean by pretty well, boy."
A whitewash on the forehead hardens the brain into a state of obstinacy, perhaps. Anyhow, with whitewash from the wall on my forehead, my obstinacy was adamantine. I reflected for some time, and then answered as if I'd discovered a new idea.
"I mean pretty well."
My sister, with an exclamation of impatience, was going to fly at me. I had no shadow of defence, for Joe was busy in the forge, when Mr. Pumblechook interposed with,
"No, don't lose your temper. Leave this lad to me, ma'am. Leave this lad to me."
Mr. Pumblechook then turned me towards him as if he were going to cut my hair, and said,
"First, to get our thoughts in order, 43p.
I calculated the consequence of replying, £400, and finding them against me, went as near the answer as I could, which was somewhere about 8p off. Mr. Pumblechook then put me through my pence table, from 12p
make 1 shilling,
up to 40p
make 3 and 4p,
and then triumphantly demanded, as if he had done for me,
"Now, how much is 43p?
To which I replied, after a long interval of reflection,
"I don't know."
And I was so aggravated that I almost doubt if I did know. Mr. Pumblechook worked his head like a screw to screw it out of me, and said,
"Is 43p 7 and 6p 3/4, for instance?"
"Yes," said I,
and although my sister instantly boxed my ears, it was highly gratifying to me to see that the answer spoilt his joke and brought him to a dead stop.
"Boy, what like is Miss Havisham?"
Mr. Pumblechook began again when he had recovered, folding his arms tight on his chest and applying the screw.
"Very tall and dark,"
I told him.
"Is she, Uncle?"
asked my sister. Mr. Pumblechook winked assent, from which I at once inferred that he had never seen Miss Havisham, for she was nothing of the kind.
"Good," said Mr. Pumblechook conceitedly. "This is the way to have him. We are beginning to hold our own, I think, Mum."
"I am sure, Uncle," returned Mrs. Joe. "I wish you had him always. You know so well how to deal with him."
"Now, boy, what was she doing of when you went in today?"
asked Mr. Pumblechook.
"She was sitting," I answered, "in a black velvet coach."
Mr. Pumblechook and Mrs. Joe stared at one another, as well they might, and both repeated,
"In a black velvet coach."
"Yes," said I. "And Miss Estella, that's her niece, I think, handed her in cake and wine at the coach window, on a gold plate, and we all had cake and wine on gold plates, and I got up behind the coach to eat mine because she told me to."
"Was anybody else there?"
asked Mr. Pumblechook.
"Four dogs," said I.
"Large or small?"
"Immense," said I, "and they fought for veal cutlets out of a silver basket."
Mr. Pumblechook and Mrs. Joe stared at one another again in utter amazement. I was perfectly frantic, a reckless witness under the torture, and would have told them anything.
"Where was this coach, in the name of gracious?"
asked my sister.
"In Miss Havisham's room."
They stared again.
"But there weren't any horses to it."
I added this saving clause in the moment of rejecting four richly caparisoned coursers, which I had had wild thoughts of harnessing.
"Can this be possible, Uncle?" asked Mrs. Joe. "What can the boy mean?"
"I'll tell you, Mum," said Mr. Pumblechook. "My opinion is it's a sedan chair. She's flighty, you know, very flighty, quite flighty enough to pass her days in a sedan chair."
"Did you ever see her in it, Uncle?"
asked Mrs. Joe.
"How could I?"
he returned, forced to the admission.
"When I never see her in my life, never clapped eyes upon her."
"Goodness, Uncle, and yet you have spoken to her."
"Why, don't you know," said Mr. Pumblechook testily, "that when I have been there, I have been took up to the outside of her door, and the door has stood ajar, and she has spoke to me that way. Don't say you don't know that, Mum. Howsoever, the boy went there to play. What did you play at, boy?"
"We played with flags," I said.
I beg to observe that I think of myself with amazement when I recall the lies I told on this occasion.
"Flags?"
echoed my sister.
"Yes," said I. "Estella waved a blue flag, and I waved a red one, and Miss Havisham waved one sprinkled all over with little gold stars, out at the coach window, and then we all waved our swords and hurrahed."
"Swords?"
repeated my sister.
"Where did you get swords from?"
"Out of a cupboard," said I, "and I saw pistols in it, and jam and pills, and there was no daylight in the room, but it was all lighted up with candles."
"That's true, Mum," said Mr. Pumblechook with a grave nod. "That's the state of the case, for that much I've seen myself."
And then they both stared at me, and I, with an obtrusive show of artlessness on my countenance, stared at them and platted the right leg of my trousers with my right hand. If they had asked me any more questions, I should undoubtedly have betrayed myself, for I was even then on the point of mentioning that there was a balloon in the yard, and should have hazarded the statement but for my invention being divided between that phenomenon and a bear in the brewery. They were so much occupied, however, in discussing the marvels I had already presented for their consideration, that I escaped. The subject still held them when Joe came in from his work to have a cup of tea, to whom my sister, more for the relief of her own mind than for the gratification of his, related my pretended experiences. Now when I saw Joe open his blue eyes and roll them all round the kitchen in helpless amazement, I was overtaken by penitence, but only as regarded him, not in the least as regarded the other two. Towards Joe, and Joe only, I considered myself a young monster, while they sat debating what results would come to me from Miss Havisham's acquaintance and favour. They had no doubt that Miss Havisham would do something for me. their doubts related to the form that something would take. My sister stood out for property. Mr. Pumblechook was in favour of a handsome premium for binding the apprentice to some genteel trade, say, the corn and seed trade, for instance. Joe fell into the deepest disgrace with both for offering the bright suggestion that I might only be presented with one of the dogs who had fought for the veal cutlets.
"It's a fool's head can't express better opinions than that," said my sister. "And you've got any work to do, you had better go and do it."
So he went. After Mr. Pumblechook had driven off, and when my sister was washing up, I stole into the forge to Joe, and remained by him until he had done for the night. Then I said, "Before the fire goes out, Joe, I should like to tell you something."
"Should you, Pip?"
said Joe, drawing his shoeing stool near the forge.
"Then tell us. What is it, Pip?"
"Joe," said I, taking hold of his rolled-up shirt-sleeve and twisting it between my finger and thumb, "you remember all that about Miss Havisham's?"
"Remember?" said Joe. "I believe you. Wonderful."
"It's a terrible thing, Joe. It ain't true."
"What are you telling of, Pip?"
cried Joe, falling back in the greatest amazement.
"You don't mean to say it's—"
"Yes, I do. It's lies, Joe."
"But not all of it. Why, sure, you don't mean to say, Pip, that there was no Blackwell with a coach?"
For I stood shaking my head.
"But at least there was dogs, Pip. Come, Pip," said Joe persuasively. "If there weren't no wheel cutlets, at least there was dogs."
"No, Joe."
"Her dog," said Joe. "A puppy. Come."
"No, Joe. There was nothing at all of the kind."
As I fixed my eyes hopelessly on Joe, Joe contemplated me in dismay.
"Pip, old chap, this won't do, old fella. I say, where do you expect to go to?"
"It's terrible, Joe, ain't it?"
"Terrible?" cried Joe. "Awful. What possessed you?"
"I don't know what possessed me, Joe," I replied, letting his shirt sleeve go and sitting down in the ashes at his feet, hanging my head. "But I wish you hadn't taught me to call knaves at cards jacks, and I wish my boots weren't so thick nor my hands so coarse."
And then I told Joe that I felt very miserable, and that I hadn't been able to explain myself to Mrs. Joe and Pumblechook, who were so rude to me, and that there had been a beautiful young lady at Miss Havisham's who was dreadfully proud, and that she had said I was common, and that I knew I was common, and that I wished I was not common, and that the lies had come of it somehow, though I didn't know how. This was a case of metaphysics, at least as difficult for Joe to deal with as for me. But Joe took the case altogether out of the region of metaphysics, and by that means vanquished it.
"There's one thing you may be sure of, Pip," said Joe after some rumination, "namely, that lies is lies. Howsever they come, they didn't ought to come, and they come from the father of lies, and work round to the same. Don't you tell no more of them, Pip. That ain't the way to get out of being common, old chap. And as to being common, I don't make it out at all clear. You are uncommon in some things. You're uncommon small. Likewise, you're an uncommon scholar."
"No, I'm ignorant and backward, Joe."
"Why, see what a letter you wrote last night. Wrote in print, even. I've seen letters, and from gentlefolks, that I'll swear weren't wrote in print," said Joe.
"I've learnt next to nothing, Joe. You think much of me. It's only that."
"Well, Pip," said Joe, "be it so or be it so'n't, you must be a common scholar afore you can be an uncommon one, I should hope. The king upon his throne, with his crown upon his head, can't sit and write his acts of parliament in print without having begun, when he were an unpromoted prince, with the alphabet." "Ah," added Joe, with a shake of his head that was full of meaning, "and begun at E, too, and worked his way to Z, and I know what that is to do, though I can't say I've exactly done it."
There was some hope in this piece of wisdom, and it rather encouraged me.
"Whether common ones, as to callings and earnings," pursued Joe reflectively, "mightn't be the better of continuing for to keep company with common ones, instead of going out to play with
uncommon ones, which reminds me to hope that there were a flag, perhaps.
No, Joe.
I'm sorry there weren't a flag, Pip. Whether that might be or mightn't be is a thing as can't be looked into now without putting your sister on the rampage, and that's a thing not to be thought of as being done intentional. Looky here, Pip, as what is said to you by a true friend, which this to you the true friend say, if you can't get to be uncommon through going straight, you'll never get to it through going crooked. So don't tell no more of 'em, Pip, and live well and die happy.
You're not angry with me, Joe?
No, old chap, but bearing in mind with them, were which I mean to say of a stunning and outdacious sort, alluding to them which bordered on wheel cutlets and dog-fighting, a sincere well-wisher would advise, Pip, they're being dropped into your meditations when you go upstairs to bed. That's all, old chap. And don't never do it no more.
When I got up to my little room and said my prayers, I did not forget Joe's recommendation. And yet my young mind was in that disturbed and unthankful state that I thought long after I had laid me down how common Estella would consider Joe, a mere blacksmith, how thick his boots and how coarse his hands. I thought how Joe and my sister were then sitting in a kitchen, and how I had come up to bed from the kitchen, and how Miss Havisham and Estella never sat in a kitchen, but were far above the level of such common doings. I fell asleep, recalling what I used to do when I was at Miss Havisham's, as though I had been there weeks or months instead of hours, and as though it were quite an old subject of remembrance, instead of one that had arisen only that day. That was a memorable day to me, for it made great changes in me. But it is the same with any life. Imagine one selected day struck out of it, and think how different its course would have been. Pause, you who read this, and think for a moment of the long chain of iron or gold, of thorns or flowers that would never have bound you, but for the formation of the first link on one memorable day.
Chapter 10. The felicitous idea occurred to me a morning or two later when I woke that the best step I could take towards making myself uncommon was to get out of Biddy everything she knew. In pursuance of this luminous conception, I mentioned to Biddy when I went to Mr. Wopsle's great-aunt's at night that I had a particular reason for wishing to get on in life, and that I should feel very much obliged to her if she would impart all her learning to me. Biddy, who was the most obliging of girls, immediately said she would, and indeed began to carry out her promise within 5 minutes. The educational scheme or course established by Mr. Wopsle's great-aunt may be resolved into the following synopsis. The pupils ate apples and put straws down one another's backs until Mr. Wopsle's great-aunt collected her energies and made an indiscriminate totter at them with a birch rod. After receiving the charge with every mark of derision, the pupils formed in line and buzzingly passed a ragged book from hand to hand. The book had an alphabet in it, some figures and tables, and a little spelling. That is to say, that it had had once. As soon as this volume began to circulate, Mr. Wopsle's great-aunt fell into a state of coma, arising either from sleep or a rheumatic paroxysm. The pupils then entered among themselves upon a competitive examination on the subject of boots, with the view of ascertaining who could tread the hardest upon whose toes. This mental exercise lasted until Biddy made a rush at them and distributed 3 defaced Bibles, shaped as if they'd been unskillfully cut off the chump end of something, more illegibly printed at the best than any curiosities of literature I have since met with, speckled over with iron mould, and having various specimens of the insect world smashed between their leaves. This part of the course was hugely lightened by several single combats between Biddy and refractory students. When the fights were over, Biddy gave out the number of a page, and then we all read aloud what we could or what we couldn't in a frightful chorus. Biddy leading with a high, shrill, monotonous voice, and none of us having the least notion of or reverence for what we were reading about.
When this horrible din had lasted a certain time, it mechanically awoke Mr. Wopsle's great-aunt, who staggered at a boy fortuitously and pulled his ears. This was understood to terminate the course for the evening, and we emerged into the air with shrieks of intellectual victory. It's fair to remark that there was no prohibition against any pupil's entertaining himself with a slate, or even with the ink, when there was any, but that it was not easy to pursue that branch of study in the winter season, on account of the little general shop in which the classes were holden, and which was also Mr. Wopsle's great-aunt's sitting-room and bedchamber, being but faintly illuminated through the agency of one low-spirited dip-candle and no snuffers. It appeared to me that it would take time to become uncommon under these circumstances. Nevertheless, I resolved to try it, and that very evening Biddy entered on our special agreement by imparting some information from her little catalogue of prices, under the head of Moist Sugar, and lending me, to copy at home, a large old English D, which he had imitated from the heading of some newspaper, and which I supposed, until she told me what it was, to be a design for a buckle. Of course, there was a public house in the village, and of course Joe liked sometimes to smoke his pipe there. I had received strict orders from my sister to call for him at the Three Jolly Bargemen that evening on my way from school, and bring him home at my peril. To the Three Jolly Bargemen, therefore, I directed my steps. There was a bar at the Jolly Bargemen, with some alarmingly long chalk scores on it on the wall at the side of the door, which seemed to me to be never paid off. They had been there ever since I could remember, and had grown more than I had. But there was a quantity of chalk about our country, and perhaps people neglected no opportunity of turning it to account. It being Saturday night, I found the landlord looking rather grimly at these records, but as my business was with Joe and not with him, I merely wished him good evening and passed into the common room at the end of the passage, where there was a bright, large kitchen fire, and where Joe was smoking his pipe in company with Mr. Wopsle and a stranger. Joe greeted me as usual with, "Hello, Pip, old chap," and the moment he said that, the stranger turned his head and looked at me. He was a secret-looking man whom I'd never seen before. His head was all on one side, and one of his eyes was half shut up, as if he were taking aim at something with an invisible gun. He had a pipe in his mouth, and he took it out, and after slowly blowing all his smoke away and looking hard at me all the time, nodded. So I nodded, and then he nodded again, and made room on the settle beside him that I might sit down there. But as I was used to sit beside Joe whenever I entered that place of resort, I said, "No, thank you, sir," and fell into the space Joe made for me on the opposite settle. The stranger, after glancing at Joe, and seeing that his attention was otherwise engaged, nodded to me again when I had taken my seat, and then rubbed his leg, in a very odd way, as it struck me. "You was saying," said the strange man, turning to Joe, "that you was a blacksmith."
"Yes, I said it, you know," said Joe.
"What'll you drink, Mr.—" "You didn't mention your name, by the way."
Joe mentioned it now, and the strange man called him by it.
"What'll you drink, Mr. Gargery, at my expense, to top up with?"
"Well," said Joe, "to tell you the truth, I ain't much in the habit of drinking at anybody's expense but my own."
"Habit, no," returned the stranger. "But once in a way, and on a Saturday night too. Come, put a name to it, Mr. Gargery."
"I wouldn't wish to be stiff company," said Joe.
"Rum." "Rum," repeated the stranger. "And will the other gentleman originate a sentiment?"
"Rum," said Mr. Wopsle.
"Three rums," cried the stranger, calling to the landlord. "Glasses round."
"This other gentleman," observed Joe, by way of introducing Mr. Wopsle, "is a gentleman that you would like to hear give it out. Our clerk at church."
"Uh-huh," said the stranger, quickly, and cocking his eye at me. "The lonely church right out on the marshes, with the graves round it."
"That's it," said Joe.
The stranger, with a comfortable kind of grunt over his pipe, put his legs up on the settle that he had to himself. He wore a flapping, broad-brimmed traveller's hat, and under it a handkerchief tied over his head in the manner of a cap, so that he showed no hair. As he looked at the fire, I thought I saw a cunning expression, followed by a half-laugh, come into his face.
Most marshes is solitary, said Joe.
No doubt, no doubt. Do you find any gypsies now, or tramps, or vagrants of any sort out there?
No, said Joe. None but a runaway convict now and then, and we don't find them easy, eh, Mr. Wopsle?
Mr. Wopsle, with a majestic resemblance of old discomfiture, assented, but not warmly.
Seems you've been out after such, asked the stranger.
Once, returned Joe. Not that we wanted to take them, you understand. We went out as lookers-on, me and Mr. Wopsle and Pip, didn't us, Pip?
Yes, Joe.
The stranger looked at me again, still cocking his eye, as if he were expressly taking aim at me with his invisible gun, and said,
"He's a likely young parcel of bones, that. What is it you call him?"
"Pip," said Joe.
"Chris and Pip?"
"No, not Chris and Pip."
"Surname Pip?"
"No," said Joe. "It's a kind of a family name, what he gave himself when an infant, and is called by."
"Son of yours?"
"Well,"
said Joe meditatively, not, of course, that it could be in any wise necessary to consider about it, but because it was the way at the Jolly Bargeman to seem to consider deeply about everything that was discussed over pipes.
"Well, no. No, he ain't."
"Nevy?"
said the strange man.
"Well," said Joe, with the same appearance of profound cogitation, "he is not. No, not to deceive you, he is not my nevy."
"What the blue blazes is he?"
asked the stranger, which appeared to me to be an inquiry of unnecessary strength. Mr. Wopsle struck in upon that as one who knew all about relationships, having professional occasion to bear in mind what female relations a man might not marry, and expounded the ties between me and Joe. Having his hand in, Mr. Wopsle finished off with a most terrifically snarling passage from Richard III, and seemed to think he had done quite enough to account for it when he added,
"As the poet says."
And here I may remark that when Mr. Wopsle referred to me, he considered it a necessary part of such reference to rumple my hair and poke it into my eyes. I cannot conceive why everybody of his standing who visited at our house should always have put me through the same inflammatory process under similar circumstances. Yet I do not call to mind that I was ever in my earlier youth the subject of remark in our social family circle, but some large-handed person took some such ophthalmic steps to patronize me. All this while, the strange man looked at nobody but me, and looked at me as if he were determined to have a shot at me at last, and bring me down. But he said nothing after offering his blue blazes observation, until the glasses of rum and water were brought, and then he made his shot, and a most extraordinary shot it was. It was not a verbal remark, but a proceeding in dumb show, and was pointedly addressed to me. He stirred his rum and water pointedly at me, and he tasted his rum and water pointedly at me. And he stirred it, and he tasted it, not with a spoon that was brought to him, but with a file. He did this so that nobody but I saw the file, and when he had done it, he wiped the file and put it in a breast pocket. I knew it to be Joe's file, and I knew that he knew my convict the moment I saw the instrument. I sat gazing at him spellbound, but he now reclined on his settle, taking very little notice of me, and talking principally about turnips. There was a delicious sense of cleaning up and making a quiet pause before going on in life afresh in our village on Saturday nights, which stimulated Joe to dare to stay out half an hour longer on Saturdays than at other times. Half an hour and the rum and water running out together, Joe got up to go and took me by the hand.
"Stop half a moment, Mr. Gargery," said the strange man. "I think I've got a bright new shilling somewhere in my pocket, and if I have, the boy shall have it."
He looked it out from a handful of small change, folded it in some crumpled paper, and gave it to me.
"Yours," said he. "Mind, your own."
I thanked him, stared at him far beyond the bounds of good manners, and holding tight to Joe. He gave Joe good night, and he gave Mr. Wopsle good night, who went out with us, and he gave me only a look with his aiming eye. No, not a look, for he shut it up, but wonders may be done with an eye by hiding it. On the way home, if I had been in the humour for talking, the talk must have been all on my side, for Mr. Wopsle parted from us at the door of the Jolly Bargeman, and Joe went all the way home with his mouth wide open to rinse the rum out with as much air as possible. But I was in a manner stupefied by this turning up of my old misdeed and old acquaintance, and could think of nothing else. My sister was not in a very bad temper when we presented ourselves in the kitchen, and Joe was encouraged by that unusual circumstance to tell her about the bright shilling.
"A bad un, I'll be bound," said Mrs. Joe triumphantly, "or he wouldn't have given it to the boy. Let's look at it."
I took it out of the paper, and it proved to be a good one.
"But what's this?"
said Mrs. Joe, throwing down the shilling and catching up the paper.
Two 1-pound notes?"
Nothing less than two fat, sweltering 1-pound notes that seemed to have been on terms of the warmest intimacy with all the cattle markets in the country. Joe caught up his hat again and ran with them to the Jolly Bargeman to restore them to their owner. Whilst he was gone, I sat down on my usual stool and looked vacantly at my sister, feeling pretty sure that the man would not be there. Presently Joe came back, saying that the man was gone, but that he, Joe, had left word at the Three Jolly Bargemen concerning the notes. Then my sister sealed them up in a piece of paper and put them under some dried rose leaves in an ornamental teapot on top of a press in the state parlour. There they remained, a nightmare to me, many and many a night and day. I had sadly broken sleep when I got to bed, through thinking of the strange man taking aim at me with his invisible gun, and of the guiltily coarse and common thing it was to be on secret terms of conspiracy with convicts, a feature in my low career that I had previously forgotten. I was haunted by the file, too. A dread possessed me that when I least expected it, the file would reappear. I coaxed myself to sleep by thinking of Miss Havisham's next Wednesday, and in my sleep I saw the file coming at me out of a door, without seeing who held it, and I screamed myself awake. Chapter 11. At the appointed time, I returned to Miss Havisham's, and my hesitating ring at the gate brought out Estella. She locked it after admitting me, as she had done before, and again preceded me into the dark passage where her candle stood. She took no notice of me until she had the candle in her hand, when she looked over her shoulder, superciliously saying, "You are to come this way today," and took me to quite another part of the house. The passage was a long one, and seemed to pervade the whole square basement of the manor house. We traversed but one side of the square, however, and at the end of it she stopped, and put her candle down and opened a door. Here the daylight reappeared, and I found myself in a small paved courtyard, the opposite side of which was formed by a detached dwelling-house that looked as if it had once belonged to the manager or head clerk of the extinct brewery. There was a clock in the outer wall of this house, like the clock in Miss Havisham's room and like Miss Havisham's watch. It had stopped at 9:20. We went in at the door, which stood open, and into a gloomy room with a low ceiling on the ground floor at the back. There was some company in the room, and Estella said to me as she joined it, "You are to go and stand there, boy, till you're wanted," there being the window. I crossed to it and stood there, in a very uncomfortable state of mind, looking out. It opened to the ground and looked into a most miserable corner of the neglected garden, upon a rank ruin of cabbage stalks, and one box tree that had been clipped round long ago like a pudding, and had new growth at the top of it, out of shape, and of a different colour, as if that part of the pudding had stuck to the saucepan and got burnt. This was my homely thought as I contemplated the box tree. There had been some light snow overnight, and it lay nowhere else to my knowledge, but it had not quite melted from the cold shadow of this bit of garden, and the wind caught it up in little eddies and threw it at the window as if it pelted me for coming there. I divined that my coming had stopped conversation in the room, and that its other occupants were looking at me. I could see nothing of the room except the shining of the fire in the window glass, but I stiffened in all my joints with the consciousness that I was under close inspection. There were three ladies in the room and one gentleman. Before I had been standing at the window 5 minutes, they somehow